Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society Who Cares for the Caregiver conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and at that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. We ask that you please keep your questions general and ask questions which will appeal to the entire audience. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Thursday, July 7th, 2011. I would now like to turn the conference over to Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Outreach and Education with the National MS Society, Greater Northwest Chapter. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, and I'd like to thank everyone so much for registering for our July monthly teleconference called Who Cares for the Caregiver? We're so pleased to have you all on the line with us this evening for this very important topic. The Greater Northwest Chapter's monthly teleconferences are one of the many free and helpful chapter programs and services available to people living with MS and those who provide their care. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867 and press option 1, or visit us online at www.msnorthwest.org. For this evening's teleconference, I'm very excited to introduce you to our expert speakers, Jean Rose and John Bauman. John Bauman has a Master of Divinity degree and a Postmaster Certificate in Pastoral Counseling from Seattle University. He has been in ministry for the past 17 years helping individuals, couples, and families deal with grief, illness, and loss. John provides pastoral counseling and psychotherapy services in West Seattle. He has 12 years of personal experience of living with his wife's uninvited guest, MS. Additionally, John is co-hosting a couples workshop with his wife at the Evergreen MS Center in Kirkland. This is a 6-week course beginning in early October. The cost is $35 per person. Information is available at evergreenhospital.org or by calling the Evergreen Health Line at 425-899-3000. Our other speaker this evening is Jean Rose, who is a retired registered nurse, and she cared for her husband who had advanced MS. Jean developed and published the Care Book for use by caregivers, facilitated well spouse and MS family support groups, and co-authored the MS Guide for Families Caring for Loved Ones with Advanced MS. Jean has volunteered with the Inland Northwest Chapter as a member of its board, Clinical Advisory Committee, Chapter Program Committee, and as an instructor for its Gateway to Wellness course. So we're in very good company this evening with Jean and John. Following this evening's teleconference, you will receive a program evaluation by email, which we urge you to complete as your feedback and ideas are very important to us. Within that email, you will receive information about our summer teleconferences and other chapters and programs and services available to you. On that note, I would like to thank you again for being on the call this evening and would like to hand the floor off to Jean and John now. You two may begin.
Thank you, Piper. As we enter this evening, I realize that MS is unique to everyone who has been diagnosed or been challenged by the disease, both the person with MS and for those of us who are partners or caregivers. And so while Jean and I will be sharing from our own personal experience, we want to make sure that we don't make our experience normative for you. But the hope is that by sharing our stories, something will connect and some of your story will be heard. By that same token, as we address some of the strategies we have used, the hope is that you will take them and adapt them to your own circumstance, not just try to apply them in some universal fashion. So MS entered my wife's life, actually in 1988 with a bout of optic neuritis, and then went hidden for another 10 years before a second exacerbation occurred. And we were totally unaware of what was happening. I think it was, as we've experienced in conversations with others, finding the diagnosis was a great challenge for us. The primary experience in those early months were with cognitive challenges, a little bit of mobility, and I just remember wondering if anything would ever change, anything would ever get better. And I think for me, my whole focus was trying to find the cure or to try to fix Marcia, to make her better. And that ended up, eventually we had to move away from that approach and begin to live as partners. And that's part of the journey that we'll cover a bit later. And now I'm going to invite Jean to share how you first encountered MS.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jean, and as Piper said, I was the primary caregiver for my husband for about 14 years, and these years span the time from his initial diagnosis to a very advanced stage of progressive MS and ultimately his death from cancer. And I think if there's any commonality with people with MS, I think it is these first years. And when I hear John talk, I think, you know, that's kind of what we did. We, in the late 60s, we were aware that something, Jim was aware that something was going on and was in the Air Force. And the Air Force doctors kind of said, well, maybe it's a back problem. Let's go here. Let's go there. Did some spinal taps. But when we got those records after Jim retired and had been diagnosed with MS, all of those doctors, or not all maybe, but several of them said in the record, this guy probably has MS. But they never said anything to Jim about that. That diagnosis was never brought up. And his diagnosis also came one night when his eye, he could no longer see out of one of his eyes, and the ophthalmologist the next day diagnosed the optic neuritis, and from then came the diagnosis of MS. I remember how relieved Jim was that he had a diagnosis. One doctor said, you either have MS or you have a brain tumor. And when he found out he had MS, he thought, wow, well, that's certainly a lot better than having a brain tumor. But having a diagnosis, I remember, was a great relief to him because of all these weird symptoms that had been going on. He was glad to know that at least there was a name to it. I think one of my first memories that I remember after Jim was diagnosed, he had been referred to a doctor. And when we went to the doctor's office, I assumed I'd be able to go into the room with Jim, but I was very cleverly kept from going in. And the second visit, the same thing happened. And so I confronted the doctor and asked why, what was this policy that she had for me not being able to be in the room when she was visiting with him. And she said very plainly that Jim was her patient, he was the one with MS, and that, I don't know if she put it in words, but the thought was that I really had no business in there and that she wasn't interested in my thought. And I remember saying to her that if she thought the disease only affected the patient, she was sadly mistaken. And little did I realize how right I was, because certainly over the years, and we'll talk more about these different things, Jim's MS greatly affected me. But we'll talk about this as we go on today, and I'll turn it back to John.
Okay. Thanks, Jean. Again, this is John. So as MS entered more strongly, Marcia wasn't able to drive. She lost the use of her right hand. We started a steroid treatment that and then soon got on one of the disease-modifying therapies. We didn't know the extent of what was going to happen or how it was going to develop. And eventually, what Marcia really ends up with is I can't say mild, but at least physically, it's fairly mild. So it's relapsing, remitting. There hasn't been a major exacerbation since. And I remember this topic just strikes me. Who cares for the caregiver? I can remember in those early years people asking how Marcia was, and then they would turn and ask how I was. And I didn't even want to talk about the question of how I was because Marcia was the one who was suffering with MS, and I was trying to put all of my focus on her. So while professionally I would work with parish members around illness and grief and talk about partners and caregivers, I didn't do that for myself. I was going to conquer this disease and get on top of it. So Marcia's main challenge that we faced, the biggest challenge, was around cognitive issues, especially when Marcia got fatigued, got tired. And we had this time in which, at that time, we were doing so many things jointly, doing so much work together, making plans together, reviewing finances, long-range planning, all the stuff that Marcia was now not able to do. And I can remember one time in particular. It was at the end of a day. It was probably 9 o'clock at night. And there was something I wanted to talk with Marcia about. And she just wasn't able to focus. She really wasn't able to say, I can't help. I'm not able to process this. I wasn't getting a response. And I remember at the time I got so angry that Marcia wasn't responding. It felt as if she was ignoring me. And the reality was that MS was present. MS was keeping her from addressing the issue. Now, I knew intellectually about cognitive challenges, but that was my first real experience of what was happening. And I literally had to leave the room so I wouldn't get mad at Marcia and eventually kind of figure out what was happening and then try to figure out a way to change how we did some of this joint decision-making. I knew something had to change. We had to figure out a way to keep that value of doing things together alive. So cognitive issues is one of the big challenges that we face with MS. And Jean, I know you faced a number of challenges as well. What would be one of the two of the significant challenges you faced with multiple sclerosis?
Well, we didn't. The cognitive part was not part of our lives. And the difference between Marcia and Jim, I think, seems to be that he had the physical challenges. We had, one day one leg would work, the next day neither leg would work, the nights of going down into the family room to watch television. And then he wouldn't be able to get up the stairs again. And he'd have to pull himself up the stairs with the railing, laying on his stomach and pulling himself up. And I can remember I couldn't help him. I was in the bedroom crying because I knew how difficult it was for him to do that. We didn't attempt, nor did I attempt, to try and make any changes in the disease. We just were working constantly on adapting to all of the changes. I'd just like to tell one story from John talking about how angry he got when he left the room. It's amazing how the feelings that you can have and how sometimes I just felt so dense even though I was a nurse. And one morning Jim woke up and he couldn't walk. And I helped him from the bed. We had a deck off our bedroom, a slider and a deck, and I helped him onto the slider. I set him down in a chair, you know, on the deck. I don't know why I felt he'd be better off outside, but the chair was there, I guess. I brought a little table. I poured coffee in the thermos, and I set a thermos of coffee and a cup on a little table next to him. And I turned around and went to work. And I drove to work, and I got to my office, and I sat down at my desk, and all of a sudden I thought, what on earth are you doing? I left him there. He couldn't walk. He couldn't leave the chair even. And I just turned around, got back in my car, and went home and started dealing with the problem. But I think the impact is so great that sometimes you just can't process the sadness of it all.
You know, I think, Jean, that's really true. When I talk about conquering MS, I think in the first 6 months after Marcia's formal diagnosis, in the Seattle area, not only the MS Society, but there was the MS Association of King County, which has since merged with the Northwest chapter, was in existence. And there would be seminars and presentations a couple of months. So we were driving, I would be dragging Marcia to these seminars to learn more about MS. I think I ordered the MS Society nationally had a library of books, and I got every little booklet that they produced at the time. And I was just going to learn, and I was dragging Marcia to make sure she learned all this stuff. It's almost as if the focus was on the disease, on MS, more than it was on us, at least in that mm-hmm. interim term. And I think we could, for a mm-hmm. short time, it seemed to work, but I think at 6 months, we just got tired. I looked at Marcia one night, we're going to go to one more seminar, and I asked her, do you really want to go? And she said, no, I just want to rest. And again, in that early stage, I was driving Marcia. So we live in a little town called Renton, south end of Lake Washington. I'd be driving Marcia to Bellevue to work. She was still able to go in. I would turn around and drive to Covington, which is about 45 miles south of Bellevue, to do my stuff, and then try to do the reverse in the evening and sometimes go back for evening meetings. And I think later it was an insane schedule, something really crazy to try to do. But I was so much in the response mode that I almost wasn't able to step back and think about what was really happening and how we were going to approach and address this in the long term. It was just like, let's just do today or this week. And we weren't able to step back and look out a bit longer.
I think of the steps of the grieving process many times, and I know that the last step is acceptance, but I always thought that the next one should be added, and that should be adaptation, because there is more to it than just accepting. You have to start doing something about it.
I would certainly agree with that. And I think sometimes we have this grieving process or the steps we go through, we may go through them in different sequences sometimes
mm-hmm.
and jump around so that there's a great little book I've used for people with, it's called, it's a book, actually it's a Psalms of Lament, but there's a little phrase in there that always catches me. Which was it was a prayer. Basically, it's please save me from the people who come up and say there are 10 correct steps to go through this journey.
Mm.
That allow me. Basically, was it allow me to live my journey, and work with this journey as it unfolds, instead of being being put through some process that's going to make me different when I come out at the other end. And I think that's true. That's been true for us, especially as we've been able to take stuff that we've done and just adapt pieces and encounter things that just catch me still by surprise. My wife, Marcia, has been in 10 different MS studies at different times, and it all will deal with cognitive issues. And I remember, so there would be pieces, I'm trying to say, is it PASAT? There's a counting numbers where you're given a series of two numbers to add, then you take the second number and add it to the next number. There's that piece. There are these memory games. There was one in which we were to, you walk 10 feet to a line and back, and then 20 feet to a line and back, and then 30 feet to a line and back, and at the same time you go through the alphabet and to see if you can do that together. And I remember there was a time when Marcia asked me to leave the room when she was doing one of these tests because she didn't want me to see how bad she was doing from her perspective. And I remember it was tough to leave, but I had to leave. I had to allow her to say, this is what I need. And I recognized at that very moment I was a visitor in this world of MS. Even though it impacts me in my own way, the experience of MS is something that I will... The intimate experience of MS being in me is not something that I will ever know. At least probably not know. And I would never get the full extent of it. And there's no way Marcia can share with me that full extent, because that's an experience that I won't have.
That's something that we found in support groups. And in our support group, and I remember Jim saying one time, when I say that I'm tired to the people in the support group, they know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
They know what that means. So it is true that only those with MS can understand the true meaning of what it's like.
Well, Jean, are we ready to do some questions for this first part?
I think that would be good.
Okay, Felix, we're ready for some questions. And so we'll go from now to about, say, between 5 and 10 after.
Okay, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Now, you will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment for the first question. As a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our first question comes from the line of Debbie Zillmer. Your line is now open.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, as a caregiver, and I've been a caregiver for my wife for about the last 14 years, how do you handle other people that don't understand the limitations of MS? Where, as a caregiver, you know the limitations, and yet you get ridiculed almost for not socializing enough or shopping enough. That's my question.
I'll jump in here for just a second, John,
okay.
Because this reminds me of a story that happened to us, and... We had some friends over to the house. It's difficult for someone in a wheelchair or is involved with Jim to go to other people's homes, so we had people here. But anyway, this friend of ours turned to Jim during the evening, and he said to him, you know, the reason that we don't invite you to our home is because we don't know how you would go to the bathroom.
Absolutely.
And I thought, what a brave thing for him to say. And Jim just took it very well. He said, you don't need to worry about that. He said, I have a tube down my leg and a bag on my leg, and you don't have to worry about me going to the bathroom. But I think people don't understand all of the problems that you have, and I always felt it was good just to meet them head on. And Jim was a little more reticent about talking about the limitations, but I always thought it was best just to get it out in the open.
Yeah, that is a hard one to. It's a challenge, especially if it's fatigue or cognition, if it's what we sometimes call the hidden conditions or hidden results of MS, which would be again, fatigue, cognition, because you look healthy. Marcia will look healthy. It looks like she should be able to do stuff. She plays the piano, but it takes her a month to learn to try to pick up even the basics of a new piece. She can't play it instantaneously. It just takes work. And people, there's an expectation because she can actually play well that she can pick stuff up faster than she's able. Boy, I just say it's hard to have patience in those situations.
You have no idea.
It's just extremely tough. I mean, the easy ways are, is this family that's kind of impatient, or good friends, or is...
Can I reply?
Sure.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I wasn't sure. I could. No, it's almost like expectations from the social level. The family knows the limitations of my wife.
Okay.
On the social level, I just don't... They don't understand that, you know, your toilets aren't set up for her. You know, it's just so hard. And then, you know, when I turn on invitations, it makes me look like the bad guy as a caregiver. And, you know, a couple times I've gotten in a couple of their faces and says, you just don't understand.
Okay, yeah.
Is your wife in a wheelchair?
Yes, she is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you've heard this so many times. You know, I say, well, you know, it's tough getting into somebody else's house with these wheelchairs. And they'd always say, well, you know, we've only got one or two steps. It's not really a problem. You can do it. And Jim hated to be lifted. You know, people were always wanting to pick the wheelchair up and lift him up the stairs or in the... And it is hard to try and explain that to people.
Gosh, it's hard and you're vulnerable. And I don't, my only approach is when we get invited, and we've become very selective on activities that we do. We will say, stop, I'll look ahead over a two-week period, and we'll have to schedule some break time, some downtimes in, to make sure Marcia doesn't get overextended. And I just try to thank people for invitations and say we're unable to come. And I guess I've come to the point that those folks who might choose to get upset about that, I'm not going to be able to do much about it. And I probably just, I won't look to deep friendships or doing stuff together in those situations.
Well, I thank you very much for your time and your advice.
Okay.
You have a good evening, and I wish us all well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Our next question comes to the line of Linda Moran. Your line is now open.
Hi. I've had MS now for 10 years, and my question is, how much do you tell even your good friends who have been with you through the early parts, but now the changes are starting to happen and you can't even do the things that they adapted to. And I don't want to burden them with all the facts, but on the other hand, I'm trying to help them understand what's different and what's changing, because I still look good, I still can talk, I still can walk, but sometimes I can't.
Well, Linda, are these are the friends who are part of kind of your support team or support group?
Yeah, I live 3,200 miles from my family because I moved out here for graduate school in Washington. Yeah. And so I am blessed with a pretty good group of friends, but some of them really understand MS because they have relatives with it, but some, they're good friends from my church that I've known for many years, but they're still trying to understand why I can't do things, why I get tired between events, particularly because I'm so social.
This came in one of the workshops we did. One of the participants suggested choosing a few good friends who understand, and maybe it could involve, and somebody from church would be part of this group, maybe three or four, who might be like your board of directors or your key advisors, and you can pose the question to them and let them discuss it. You'd be part of the conversation, and they'd be able to share advice back to you on how best to share it. And maybe in some circumstances, when you are overwhelmed with it, you might empower them to speak for you about this, or they might be able just to say, no, this isn't a good idea, or this is a challenge that I see. And they could help you. So that's just not your task alone. But you're almost building a safety net, a personal safety net of key people who will help you address this changing or evolving situation.
That's a great suggestion. I hadn't thought of that.
Or the other thing that I think worked for us sometimes, because rather than saying to someone that, no, we couldn't do this, like going out to dinner or something, just to say we want to try, but this could happen, and I would outline what could happen, and then we're going to have to leave early, or we're going to have, kind of giving them the idea of a plan, but still trying to do it, rather than saying, no, I just can't go because I sometimes just get so tired.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yes, and fatigue gets in the way of me doing things. And what I'm learning is I need time, like a day before and a day after, to get ready for something and then to recover from it.
Yeah.
Can try to do it.
Oh, yes, and I do.
Yeah.
I just pay for it when I do too much, when I feel good.
Sure.
Yeah, right.
And the other piece is for anybody on the line where the challenge of communicating involves physical challenges. The Northwest chapter, and you could get back with Piper to get how they have done it. They periodically do some little pieces to show able-bodied people what the challenges are. For example, they'll have somebody, you put a high heel on one foot and a flipper on the other foot and try to walk. Or you put a heavy rubber glove on a hand and then try to find something inside a purse or in a bag, identify objects. And they have a couple of physical challenges like that to give people, those who don't know MS, a sense of what some of the challenges are and how frustrating it might be. And sometimes that experience, even though it's not an MS experience, it mimics or model some of the challenges enough that it becomes an aha, that this is more challenging than I think. I mean, I see your hand that looks normal, and yet to you, trying to feel an object, it's like having this big glove on. And that might be, especially for people at church who don't quite who want to understand, most likely, but just don't quite understand.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Felix, I think we've got time for one more question in this part.
As a reminder, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone.
And if we don't get one, we can proceed.
There are no more questions from the phone lines at this time.
Okay. Well, this next part is we've kind of named some of our challenges and how we respond to those challenges is what we want to cover next. And sometimes how we respond changes us. I noticed for me and for Marcia, it was actually a retreat that Marcia was on that ushered in a huge change. I was acting really as Marcia's caregiver, which is almost a one-sided event. I was caring for Marcia as if in our relationship, Marcia's the one that needed to be cared for. And in this retreat, in the midst of it, Marcia came back and shared the insight was that she noticed everybody was reaching, she felt that people were reaching out to help Marcia with MS, but the real Marcia, who she was as a person, was reduced to the shadows, was pushed back to the shadows, that her core person was, everybody was addressing MS and not her. Well, and she didn't direct this at me, but I started wondering, how was I doing that? And then I recognized, so we're married, we have these vows, caring for each other, sickness, health, for better or for worse, and I was doing my darndest to live into my wedding vows, but it didn't make space for Marcia to live her wedding vows back to me. The caregiving was one-sided, as if I really didn't make space for Marcia to offer what she was able to offer to me. And once that insight came, I didn't change any of the things I was doing, but it was almost freeing up that Marcia, that MS does not limit ultimately what Marcia has to offer. It may change it, but it doesn't limit it. So that little piece was just a huge dramatic change for me. And we began using language like care partner. So while I may do things that Marcia's not able to do, it's a partnership. Marcia's able to ask for what she needs. She's able to direct. She certainly can tell me, I don't want help with this. I don't need you to do this. I want to try to do this. It also then gives me the freedom to allow Marcia to try and maybe to struggle with a little something while being on hand to help if help is truly needed, to respond to her. That became one way in which we began to deal with the challenge. And with cognition, I have to write schedules down and put stuff down on paper for Marcia to find. That's something that's up to me to do. Not something I like to do. I kind of like just to remember stuff, but I've had to restructure some of the things I do so that Marcia stays informed. I end up having to repeat daily schedules. What am I doing today, or what's the big event for the day? So I may do it even about this conference call. Probably had to mention it several different times. When it was, would I be doing it from the office? Would I be doing it from home? And it's just a matter of just knowing that that's going to happen, and I've got to choose to be patient and not get upset when I would normally expect somebody to remember something on a schedule. And Jean, I'll turn it to you. What, in terms of that same piece, the how do you maintain in working with your husband, a positive attitude and address the changes you felt happening in yourself?
Well, I think it's it is difficult when someone physically is so terribly helpless to still try and make them feel like they're an important part of the daily life. I know one thing that I used to do when I had my time off, I had 5 hours a week when I was away from home. We had a caregiver that came in from 10 to 3 on Tuesdays. And that was my time. And it also was Jim's time because he liked having that time away from me. And so Joe would come at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and I would leave and go do my thing, whether it be lunch with my friends or whatever. I took a lot of time planning my 5 hours every week. But one thing I would do with Jim was before Joe got there, I'd say, Jim, you know, there's things that you and Joe need to get done today. You need to get gas in that van, and you need to get it washed. Maybe you could go to Eggers and get some shoulder bacon. But when Joe came, I never said anything to Joe about these errands, which, of course, he had to do, you know, to help Jim. Jim couldn't do them. But Jim was very always excited about when Joe came. Boy, Gene has some things that we need to do today, and we better get going on this. So it was important for him to give the message to Joe about what we needed to do. And I found that it was also important for me to let him, give him time to make a decision. I couldn't ask him a question and expect him to answer me immediately. And I would often say to him, now think about this, and then come back and give me an answer. He never once ever forgot to give me the answer, but he did need the time to think. And I think it gave him a sense of doing something, being part of our, when we built a new home, it was hard for me to find things for him to be responsible for because he couldn't come and see it or do anything. But it is important to give them a sense of still being important, even though there's no physical movement that they can that he could make. Something else. I had something else, but I lost it. So go ahead, John.
Okay. And one thing that is finally, quite honestly, this came really out of when I went back for the pastoral counseling and pastoral psychotherapy degree, is how to frame dealing with MS. And it was really about taking MS and changing it from being a verb to make it a noun, to name it as an entity. And so in doing that, I'm back to that early experience I mentioned earlier with cognition and asking Marcia to participate in making this decision when she wasn't able to. What we've come to when this experience happens and Marcia is not able to participate, we change the language. So Marcia's not saying no to doing this decision making, MS is saying no. And when MS says no to doing this, then I've got to step back and say, no, there's some way how we want to be together that's being impacted here. And it was making a joint decision. And then it's about finding out a way for the two of us to say yes to doing this work together or making a decision together or making decisions together. We can say yes even though MS says no. Now, we may not be able to say yes in the manner we could 15 years ago, but we can still say yes. And we celebrate the way in which we're able to say yes today. And in that way, it takes some of the power away from MS. The other part, it keeps me and keeps Marcia from blaming her for the challenge, because The great challenge with a disease like MS is it's experienced through the person with MS. All the symptoms are experienced through Marcia. But Marcia is not her symptoms. Marcia is something more, much, much more than that. And so naming the challenge as MS when it arises has allowed us to put a focus on the disease instead of a focus on the person when a challenge comes up. Well, Gina, do you think we're ready for a couple more questions?
I just wanted to say one more thing about,
sure.
Go back just a second to what you were talking about earlier on asking for help or giving help. I think that's a tough one for people. And you go in two different directions. I know one of the gals in our support group came to the meeting one night, and she was so terribly angry at her daughter because her daughter had come to visit, and the gal in our support group had been vacuuming the living room. And she said, I didn't have the energy to put the vacuum away. And my daughter came and spent the whole afternoon visiting there and never put the vacuum away for me. And so I said, well, did you ask her to do that? And she said, no, she ought to have known that I needed her to do that. And we had the same, kind of the same problem here at our house, where I would say to Jim, if you need help, you must ask me, because you can't make me constantly responsible to know what you need.
Yeah.
And those different feelings can be very, very difficult, can be tiring for a couple to cope with. It's just something I wanted to bring up, because I'm sure the people in the audience that are listening have had both of those feelings of
Absolutely.
Not wanting to ask for help or being the person that that needed to help you, but they wanted you to ask and not always have to come up with it on their own. I just wanted to mention that. And I think you're right. We can see if there's any questions.
Okay. Felix, we're ready for some questions.
Absolutely. Once again, to register for a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Our first question comes from the line of David Dance. Your line is now open.
David?
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Jean Dance from Bellevue, Washington.
Yes,
hi, Jean.
I am a person with MS for over 30 years, have a wonderful husband on the other end of the line that's taken care of me, but my main problem is, besides being in a wheelchair, and you all know that one, I have had for a long time this wonderful problem called trifacial neuralgia, so my darn face hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And my food person says probably anything sweet or anything white, which includes sugar, of course, is responsible for it. And so what in the world do you eat?
Wow.
Well, I know that's a very extremely, extremely painful thing. And I think it's something, you know, a lot like migraine headaches, and that there's certain things that trigger it in certain people. And I don't think it is just the sugar thing. Have you been evaluated by a neurosurgeon or a neurologist?
Actually, by a kinesiologist. He's the one that has helped me for about the last 15 years and tries to help me eat the right thing. He says anything white, which means, pasta or flour or sugar or anything that's white. And lots of protein. He says your body needs protein, and that would help your face, which it does. If I get protein first thing in the morning, then that helps a lot so I can talk better like I am right now. But sometimes
well.
I can't get the words out because the face hurts too bad.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a terrible, terrible pain. And I know some have had surgery, successful surgery for it. And I can't give any more suggestions for anything else you can do. I think, like I say, if there's something that helps you, then you're just going to, you know, need to do it, like the doing the extra protein in the morning and staying away from the sugar.
I love fruit very, very much, and sometimes, you know, that's too sweet, too, like yummy grapes and yummy watermelon and all that. All
well,
that
there's
kind
a
of
lot
good.
Of sugar in fructose, you know, in fruit,
yeah.
So that probably can, yeah, it's hard when you're so limited in what you can eat.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry. I wish
I'm sure
had
it would.
A magic bullet, yeah.
My poor husband doesn't know what in the world to feed me. He said, what do you want to eat? And I said, I frankly don't know what I want to eat.
Right, yeah. Oh, very difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's outside my area of expertise, certainly.
Maybe get another opinion from a neurologist.
Well, the other thing I wanted to say is that people are just wonderful. I haven't had any trouble. My husband does asking people for help, but I don't. And when he says, no, we're doing fine, I'll say, well, I could use a little help or, you know, something like that.
That's good.
And,
Jean, just a thought for I don't know if this would help, but MS Navigator, that's the MS Society, National MS Society, and the MS Navigator is... That whole role is to help find either resources, and you might call that. You could get it through the national hotline. I think you can get connected there with a navigator, and they might be able. They might know of any research or studies connection between what you're dealing with and EMS, and might have some places where you could go, at least to begin to get some more information.
Okay,
no,
that's a good idea.
Yeah,
no guarantee,
that is.
But
the other thing about the navigator, my hand is, I used to play the piano and be a secretary and all that sort of thing, but my right hand is so goofy that it takes me a long time on the computer, and so I have Dragon Speaking, actually the ninth version, but I need to learn how to use it better because it takes me too long to correct it. Do you know anything better than Dragon Speaking to talk to the computer?
You know, I don't. I'm not aware of any at this point. But again, I would always call. I don't know if the MS Navigator again might have some ideas on some. Chapters that offer some training or have some
okay.
Help with that. It's almost like the resources are around, and this role of the navigator is to kind of gather them at least where to send you, and that's not a bad place to start.
Okay, I didn't know what that word meant as far as MS was concerned, so I've just ask for somebody that I knew, you know, rather than the navigator.
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck, Jean.
Thank you.
There are no more questions from the phone lines at this time.
Okay.
We're about out of time, I think.
We're about out of time. Any final thoughts? I guess just a couple of thoughts that came to me along the way, just some concepts that happened very right after Marcia was first diagnosed. A coworker of mine, a friend, sat down with us and asked this great question. How are you going to spend your energy dollars?
Mm-hmm.
And we went, huh? He says, well, you have limited energy dollars, and actually MS is going to take more of those energy dollars. So where do you want to spend them? Do you want to have somebody mow your grass so you can go do something else? Do you want to change yard? What changes do you want to make so you spend your energy dollars where you want to spend them? And that concept of energy dollars and where we want to spend them has been a great concept for us. So we really look at life now from the standpoint of where do we want to spend our energy dollars, meaning we can't do everything, as opposed to really a focus on what we're not able to do. That would be my final piece, I think.
I think that's very important. I think it's a great concept, and one that you can wake up in the morning thinking. I think Linda who was talking about, you know, running out of energy for some of the things.
Yeah.
She's a very outgoing person and wanted to do everything. But you do need to kind of prioritize, and if you're going to do this tonight, you probably can't do this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking of it as a bank account and what you have to spend, I think, is a very good way to do it.
Yeah. And then maybe any time we say no to doing something, it's earning interest in our energy bank account. That means we'll be able to say yes to something.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid to say no. No just means at some point you're going to be able to say yes to something that you really want to do.
Yeah. It's good. Well, thank you, everyone.
Okay. Yeah, I want to thank you. That kind of brings us to our conclusion. I would just certainly say if questions arise, I know Piper has a follow-up survey coming to you. There'll be a way to contact her. And questions that come, certainly call your local MS chapter. If it's a Greater Northwest chapter, or if you're the Inland chapter, wherever you're listening from, give them a call. And I'm sure they'll be able to provide whatever assistance they're able, and they'll be happy to do so. So,
Felix,
I think...
Absolutely. Felix, still there?
I am.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.